Well, we're going to talk about our angelic friends. Well, we have a few, I think. So, to remind you, because we've been away for a few weeks with our First Stone ministry being here, and we're looking at what the Bible reveals about angels and God's world that He created is a material world, so it has matter, dirt and trees and all of that. It has animals in it. And then, and that would include, I'm using that in the most general sense of insects and so forth, non-human things that are moving around. And then it has plant life in it. And then we have angelic life. So we have four kinds of living things and beings in the world in which God created. We said that the angels were mentioned 108 times in the Old Testament and 165 times in the New Testament, so they play a very prominent role. And their being mentioned isn't just a mention in passing, it's a mention about something they're doing, something they're engaged in, something about them that shows activity. Remember, the word angel, angelos, means messenger. And they minister to the saints, Hebrews chapter 1, verse 14. And one of the ways they would do this is to protect us. And apparently when we look at some point at Daniel's prayer, they are involved in answering prayer. Apparently there is, when we're praying, not only are we fighting the flesh to do that and to trust God, but there is something going on in the heavenlies between the angelic world and the demonic world in answering prayers. So apparently the demons are fighting against that, and the angels are the ones that are bringing us answers to prayers, at least at some times. When people ask you, do you believe that there's life other than on earth? The answer is yes. We know there's life. I mean, the Bible is full of it that's going on in this universe and so forth. And I, you know, when we looked at the first part, we talked about whether it's religion or philosophy or poetry or even science, they're all interested in life that's out there. And I gave you science, of course, Carl Sagan's famous for that, but also just conservative things like National Geographic. And they've had technology set up to try to pick up sound waves of life on other planets and so forth. So everybody's interested in this and have been. It's not just Christians and so forth, but it's everyone. And we believe, of course, there is life. And then I think that belief in life beyond this world is innate in us. I think we were created with that. So it doesn't matter if you become an atheist, then you become a scientist looking for life somewhere. See, or you become a poet and you dream about it and you just wish it would be. It's kind of like utopia. I think utopia is in us. I think we know intuitively, human beings know that something's wrong, that we weren't designed for this. We don't fit in this system as it is, and so ultimately we die and we get injured and we get crippled and all kinds of things happen and they just don't seem right. And I think that's because God created us to live in Eden and utopia. And so we don't believe we can bring it about, but we believe that God will bring it about. The angels, there are different classes, and we're not as it's not as dogmatic and clear line, but there are different categories mentioned in this celestial world, and we find angels and archangels and cherubim and seraphim. And if there's any kind of divisions like there are in the fallen, when we find in Ephesians 6:12, rulers and powers and world forces and spiritual forces of wickedness in heavenly places, so it could be spiritual forces of goodness. And it does appear, again, if you go back to Daniel's time, it does appear that the angels do have different responsibilities and maybe even different abilities that they exercise as they serve God. Ephesians chapter 1, verse 21 through 22 says that Christ is far above them. So there are these angelic powers. They are powerful. They are innumerable. They're in a constant war. But it doesn't tell us that Christ is above them. It says He is far above them. So it's not a challenge to Him or the triune God. Colossians 1:16 and 17, and all of them were created by Him and for Him. And the rebellion that took place when those that chose to sin with Lucifer, and Lucifer became the devil and they became demons, that did not thwart God's plan. God always knew that they would do that. In Jesus it says, and in Him all things hold together. Now what I want you to realize though and think about is that this innumerable host, so I don't know how many you're thinking of, you know, 500 or whatever. I mean, we just come up with numbers, but it's innumerable. And so innumerable means at least it's really big. I mean, there's really a lot of them and probably more than what we're thinking. So if we're thinking of a number, it's probably more. Because it's innumerable, you see. So it's being used to show us that it doesn't mean that it can't be counted in the infinite degree. It's just showing us that if you're thinking of some kind of, you know, whether it's thousands, it must be thousands of them. No, they're innumerable. It's trying to get us beyond that. They are powerful. They are more powerful than man ever dreamed of being. And they are active. The term means messenger. So they are not just sitting around. They are actively being dispatched. And the angels are being dispatched by God. And the demons are being dispatched by Satan. So they inhabit what would be the universe. And maybe beyond. I don't really know what the limitation is. But I know they have a very big space. You say, well, would they ever run into each other or run out of space? Well, you think about it. Here I'm going to give you a little bit of insight into that. Brian Koberlein, he's an astrophysicist and a physics professor at Rochester Institute of Technology. And he says, quote, the currently observable universe has a diameter of 92 billion light years. 92 billion. So a light year is how far light can travel at 186,000 miles per second. 92 billion light years. Diameter is the line across. So you got a circle and it's this line. So it's not around it. In other words, to cross it, to go from one side to the other at the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, it would take you 92 billion years, not million, billion years. Now that's what we call wide open spaces. They have room. It doesn't matter how many there are. There's a lot of room out there. Brent Tully, he's an astronomer at the University of Hawaii, and he says, light travels at 186,000 miles per second. That's top speed in this universe. Nothing can go faster. The nearest big galaxy to our Milky Way, the Andromeda galaxy, is 2 million light years away. So that's the closest one. So we can see it. It's our neighbor. And then he says, the most distant galaxies we can now see are 10 to 12 billion light years away. So we're here, and it takes all this time to go across it, but then we've got a neighbor that's 2 billion light years away. And then the ones that we can see further that live in the other neighborhoods, they're 10 to 12 billion. And remember, what happens is, that why they say that we can see now and so forth is because as technology advances, you all of a sudden can see things that they couldn't see before. NASA website says, the sun is one of 200 billion stars. Perhaps more. That's what it says in parentheses. Perhaps more. You know, give or take a billion. Just in the Milky Way galaxy alone. So far, astronomers have found more than 500 solar systems and are discovering new ones every year. Given how many they found in our own neighborhood of the Milky Way galaxy, scientists estimate that there may be tens of billions of solar systems in our galaxy, perhaps even as many as 100 billion of them. The University of California Santa Barbara science line says, quote, there are about 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, which is only one of 3,000 billion galaxies in the known universe. I mean, you can't even read it, can you? You can't keep up with it. You can't even figure it out. It's just so beyond anything we can imagine. So do they have room? Yes. They're not crowded. And they're not just contained on Earth or in our atmosphere. And so just to traverse this kind of distance that they have, and we don't know what all is going on, but just being in that kind of space, if you utilize any of it, you have to be able to travel at enormous speeds that are beyond anything that we can imagine. So again, speaking of their abilities, there's an astrophysicist that I follow, Sarah Salviander, I think is her name. And she was an atheist for most of her life, and she came to Christ and still practices being an astrophysicist. And she said, and I quote, as someone who studies the universe for a living, I find the mysteries of life and consciousness much, and much is in all capitals, much more challenging than the mysteries of, say, dark matter, galaxy formation. Human beings are far and away the most complex and impressive phenomenon in the universe. So I'm telling you about all of this, and so our mind just goes wild thinking about that, and this astrophysicist is saying, yeah, but when you think about man, he's the most complex of it all. And the consciousness is the thing that the Darwinists and all of them have had so much problem with, among other things. She said again, and she quoted Isaiah 41:13, which says, for I, the Lord your God, hold your right hand. It is I who say to you, fear not. I am the one who helps you. And this is what she said about that. It never ceases to amaze me that the God who made the galaxies with hundreds of billions of stars also cares about your daily concerns. And that's really the staggering thing, isn't it? That he really cares about what you're doing tomorrow and what's going on. And he does that for all of us. And he's not even tired at the end of the day. It's just the most staggering things to think about God and this created vast universe of these angels and then all of this matter that we know of now. And remember, that grows with technology growing that we can look and see further. In other words, sometimes they've had a telescope that could see so far and they said, this is what's out there. Now they say, as today, as seen today. Because it changes. And that God who created all of that and flung the stars into the heavens, he cares about what you're going to do in the morning and what you go through. It's the most mind-boggling thing in the world. And I often say that he's the one who knows what almost 7 billion people are thinking at every given second. And he's always known that. I just hope you can grasp we're in a totally different realm when we're talking about God. Well, the angelic realm is not God, but it's not human. It's another realm entirely. We are like a microcosmic speck. We are like an infinitesimal speck that's been split a zillion times in this vast, vast, vast universe. And I think about that in a spiritual and material way. So we talk about, we know the sinfulness of pride and all of that, but think of it in this context of this vastness of this universe that we live in, that God has created, and then these angels that can just go to and fro and on and on and on and are so powerful. It makes the sinfulness of pride, of accomplishment, even more hideous. Because we accomplish something and we should be thankful for it, and that's wonderful. But when we become prideful over something we've done, you understand, in comparison to everything around us, it's nothing. And we're prideful about it. That's the sinfulness of pride. Or when we know things that others don't know and we become prideful about our knowledge. I've just always been amazed why people who are studied and learned and so forth, and they become prideful about that knowledge because they've spent enough time in libraries to think about, okay, how many of those books have you read? I mean, just think about it. The hundreds of millions that we haven't read, the universe we have not traversed. We don't even fully understand this other group of beings that is far superior to us. And can you imagine when we're prideful about our knowledge with someone else or our accomplishments? Or I thought about our pride about when we've gone places. Isn't that some? Yeah, I've been to Florida several times. Oh, yeah, I've been to Colorado. And it's fine. And I love both those places. But when you become prideful about you traveling, it's like you traveled from one dirt clod to the other in comparison to the universe. Angels are doing this all the time, and they don't even think about it. So again, you see, it just makes our pride all the more heinous and ugly when you compare it to what if you could travel the universe in seconds, maybe. That's traveling. That's seeing something. And just think about what we don't know. We don't know. We don't even know what we don't know. But we should know that we don't know everything. And so it should cause humility. And I just think about from God's perspective, when He sees somebody prideful about their physical strength or their mental acumen or an accomplishment or you know, they live in a nice house or whatever. And God's thinking, if you understood how ugly that sin is. Because you don't even have what the demons of hell have to roam around in. And you're bragging. And so it's caused us to be thankful where we've been, what we can do, and so forth. It's just an amazing thing when you take it in the context of how vast the creation is. So the angels, they can move fast. They have a vast range to operate in. They do come to earth, but they are not confined to the earth, and they're not confined to the heavens that we see, the atmospheric heavens at least. So the Bible speaks of them as innumerable, and there is without a doubt more than ample room for them, no matter how many there are. Now, I want you to look with me in Genesis 6. And this is a cross between the... We'll study demonology later. We may even look at this again. But it's a part of this whole thing of angels and demons. And so let me tell you that there were angels that were created. So you have angels. And then you have the fallen angels. And you have They're known as demons, and you have the elect angels, and they're the ones that did not fall. They did not go with Lucifer. So you had angels, now you have demons or fallen angels, and you have elect angels. But out of the demons, you have two groups. You have the free ones and the bound ones, the imprisoned ones. So now there's actually angels, elect angels, fallen angels, and fallen angels. Some of them are bound and some are not. So there's these different groups. And the binding of these came in Genesis 6, and what I believe this is referring to, and I'll show you the scriptures, is that angels, demons, cohabitated with human women prior to the flood. And in doing that, the women had offspring from that relationship, and that was creating a half-angelic, half-human race. And that race would have been unredeemable. So if you want to know why there had to be a serious thing like a flood that destroyed every person except eight, it's because it was an unredeemable race. And so it took drastic action. And that's what Satan's plan was. So in verse 1, now it came about when men began to multiply on the face of the land and the daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men. Now the sons of God is a phrase, I think it appears 5 times in the Old Testament, and it refers to a created group. So it can refer to Israel. Remember, Israel was created by God, and it can also refer to angels. And it's Benaha Elohim in the Hebrew. And they saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. Apparently they had the power, remember. Then the Lord said, my spirit will not always strive with man forever, because he also is flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. And that's where we get Noah preached for 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. So the sons of God, and I believe those are demons, fallen angels. And those were the mighty men who were of old, the renowned. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was continually there's only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he made man on earth, and he was grieved in his heart. Now, there's so much to talk about there, but I just want to talk about the sorriness that God is sorry. God didn't see it and become sorry. He didn't become sorry. When he created man, and I'm really cutting to the chase, with free will, he knew everything that would happen, and he knew what he would allow free will to do. And this was one of those things that would come about by free will. And that sin always grieves the heart of God. But God did not come to that grief in Genesis 6. He has always known everything. There's never been a second that he didn't know that. So when he knew he would create, he knew that would happen, and he knew that he would be sorry that they sinned. So he's always had that feeling, that sorriness. He didn't express it because no one was there to hear it. It would be meaningless. But when you come to the passage in the Bible, which is in time, he expresses that it made him sorry. And we know this because he's a holy God. But notice that there were Nephilim on the earth. And again, don't get caught up in who the Nephilim are. They're probably not these mighty men, same group. Maybe they are, but it's kind of hard to relate them to the sons of God and the ones that had relationships to women. And there is in Numbers chapter 13, verse 33, I think it is, that there are Nephilim there. So that's the two times they're mentioned. So they're mentioned before the flood and after the flood. And remember, they said, the Jews said, we're like grasshoppers in their sight. So they were men that were big and so forth. But what I want you to see is that these sons of God had relationships with women, human women. They had an offspring, and that offspring would have been half angelic and half human, and would have been an unredeemable race. And so apparently it had produced a lot, and then others that were there and weren't infected by that, they were still evil in all of their thoughts. So God had to wipe out the entire thing. Out of all of the people that were living, there were only 8 that had not been totally corrupted beyond a redeemable state. Now I want you to turn to 2 Peter. So sometimes people will tell you, well, this was the daughters of men, the sons of God. The sons of God were the sons of Seth, and the daughters of men were the daughters of Cain or Ham or something. But it just doesn't hold up. And I've heard people try to answer this in another way, but they really, when they come to these New Testament passages that speak very clearly on it, they just don't handle them well, in my estimation. So that happened, and in chapter 2 of 2 Peter, but false prophets also rose among the people, just as there will also be false teachers among you who will secretly introduce destructive heresies, even denying the master who bought them, bringing swift destruction upon themselves. Many will follow their sensuality, and because of them, the way of truth will be maligned. And in their greed, they will exploit you. And the King James used to translate that, make merchandise of you. And I just think that really captures it, that they will use you for their own profit. With false words, their judgment from long ago is not idle, and their destruction is not asleep. Now watch this. For if God did not spare the angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to the pits of darkness, reserved for judgment. So he didn't spare these angels when they sinned, but he cast them into hell. And the word hell, Hades, is a word that is used for torment, and it's the equivalent of Sheol we've talked about. But then hell is the word Gehenna in the Greek. And that was a dump, a refuge dump, and it burned and so forth. This is the word Tartarus. And so some linguists say that translators don't translate it or transliterate it because they didn't want another word that meant torment and confuse people. But it is a distinct word, and it's translated hell, and the normal word is Gehenna. But it is a place of torment. But notice that these were cast into this place, and it says, and he cast them into Tartarus and committed them to pits of darkness reserved for judgment. So remember, where are the demons? They're free. They're not in reserved for judgment. They're not in this pit. They're not in hell. They were in Jerusalem with Jesus. So this is a different group. He didn't spare them. Now watch the time frame that you see on this. Verse 5. And he did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness, with 7 others, whom he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly. So it is in the time of, it looks like it's in the time of Noah, which is exactly what we see. And then again, verse 6. And if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction by reducing them to ashes, having made them an example to those who would live ungodly lives. So he gives 3 examples of God judging apostates and sin. One of them is the angels that kept not their first estate. One of them is the world of Noah. And one of them is the world of Sodom and Gomorrah. Sodom and Gomorrah and the time of Noah are both in the Old Testament. What's not in the Old Testament, in a way that you can know anything about it, is when the angels fell with Lucifer. So the context seems to be something that they would know happened in this time frame of the Bible. And you'll see that again in Jude. So look at Jude now, verse 6. Actually, verse 5. So he's talking about ungodly people have crept into the church, verse 4. And he says, verse 5, "Now I desire to remind you, though you know all things." So he's reminding them of something that they have access to. I desire to remind you, though you know all things, once for all, that the Lord, after saving people out of the land of Egypt, subsequently destroyed those who did not believe. So that's the Exodus, the book of Exodus, and that would have been something they knew. See, and he's reminding them of that, because he's teaching them about, warning them about ungodly people who come in corrupting. And then in verse 6 he says, and the angels. So he's reminding them about Egypt, and he's reminding them about the angels who did not keep their own domain, but abandoned their proper abode. He has kept in eternal bonds and darkness for the judgment of the great day. Again, notice these are in bondage. They're imprisoned. That's not the regular demons. And notice again, he's reminding them. So it's not some event that happened before the creation, before it's not talked about, except you can take a verse or two, but he's giving them things that happened historically. He's reminding them of them. Now watch this. So when you read from verse 6, and angels who did not keep their first domain, but abandoned their proper abode, he is kept in eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day, just as, so just as, like, in the same way, you, that word, just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, since in the same way, just like, as these indulge in gross immorality, not just immorality, but gross immorality, and went after strange flesh, are exhibited as an example in the undergoing of the punishment of eternal fire. So, in Sodom and Gomorrah, what happened? The humans went after angels, strange flesh, heteros, flesh of a different kind. And so he says, just like that's what these angels, these demons did in Genesis 6, but it was the demons going after human flesh, heteros, strange flesh. So he compares those two to being the same thing. And so that again is reinforcing that these demons had relations with women. And remember, we looked at Matthew chapter 22 where it says, in heaven neither the angels are given in marriage and so forth and so on. Well, they're not in heaven. So there's a lot of things that aren't going to be true in heaven that are true here. So it doesn't mean that angels are incapable of any kind of relation that would procreate with a human. It just means they won't be doing that in heaven in any sense or way. And by the way, nor will anyone else. So, and then I want you to look at John. Let's see. Well, I thought I had it here. John chapter 8. Oh, I know where it is. No, turn to Revelation, the book of Revelation. That's what I want to go to next. Yeah, Revelation chapter 9. Now, those things to me are explicit, and they are, to me, clear. This one is what I would suggest is what's going on. Remember, these that did this, see, it was so horrendous. So demons always do bad and evil things, right? This is what they do. But apparently this was so horrendous that God would not let them be free like other demons to go around. Maybe Satan couldn't control them. Maybe once they got in this kind of evil debauchery that they couldn't be held back. It's just hard to say. But whatever it was, they were imprisoned. Where other demons doing all of their stuff, they are let free. And so there comes a time in the book of Revelation, it's Revelation chapter 9, and it's the dividing line of what's called the tribulation and the great tribulation. And the 3.5 years of the tribulation and what Jesus says is the great tribulation. And there's never been a time like it. And so it talks about the bottomless pit. And the gate was opened and let something or someone out of the bottomless pit. In verse 1, it says, "Then the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven, which had fallen to the earth, and the key of the bottomless pit." That's the word abyssos. Abyssos. "Was given to him." So the key's there, and he opened the bottomless pit, and smoke went up out of the pit, like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by the smoke of the pit. "Then out of the smoke came locusts upon the earth, and power was given them, as the scorpions of the earth have power. And they were told not to hurt the grass of the earth, nor the green thing, nor any tree, but only men who do not have the seal of God on their forehead. And they were not permitted to kill anyone, but to torment for 5 months. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings a man." Now, I don't know if you've ever been stung by a scorpion, but I have. And it goes all the way up your leg if you get stung on the foot. I mean, it is a sharp pain. Verse 6. "And in those days, men will seek death and will not find it. And they will long to die, and death will flee them." So the descriptions there of the scorpions and all of these things, I believe the bottomless pit is the same place as Tartarus, the hell, where they are bound according to Peter, and the Satan, who is the ruler of that, will be allowed to open it, and they will come to earth, and that will be the great tribulation. When the bottomless pit, the abyssos, is opened up. Now I want you to turn to the last verses, Luke chapter 8, verse 31. Luke chapter 8 and verse 31. So this is the delivering of the demoniac. And remember, the demons were in the man and Jesus was going to deliver him. And then the demons pleaded with Jesus. And this is what they said in verse 31. "And they were imploring him not to command them to go away into the abyss, the pit, the abyssos." That's the Greek word that is used of where these beings come out of in Revelation 9, that transitions from the tribulation to the great tribulation. So these demons, when he came to deliver, they said, you're not going to do that now, are you? Cast us into the abyssos. So they are very aware of this place. So I believe that those demons that did that in Genesis 6, that almost, now again, when I say almost from Satan's perspective, from a human perspective, won the battle by corrupting the whole human race. From God's vantage point, that's not true. Because God wasn't taken by it or scared by it or anything else. He knew everything that was going on. He can override anything that he wants to. But I'm just saying, from a human perspective or a demon perspective, you would look at it and say, there were only 8 left. It was almost all lost. And those that corrupted so much have been imprisoned. They're separated, and demons are still wreaking havoc all over the earth in all the different ways that they do, and Satan is. And yet these have been contained because apparently they're unmanageable. And all you have to do is to transition from the tribulation to the great tribulation is to let these back out and let them have free reign. And that message that I preach on that is called When Hell Comes to Earth. And that's when everything really gets bad. It's already pretty bad. So there's the angels, the elect angels that did not fall, the fallen angels that fell, and then the fallen angels have the free and the bound. And the bound will be let out in the tribulation. Now I want you to turn to Psalms chapter 8. Psalms chapter 8. We mentioned this morning. And so the psalmist is reflecting on the glory of God and man. And he says in verse 1, O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth, who have displayed your splendor above the heavens. From the mouth of infants and nursing babes, you have established strength because of your adversaries to make the enemy and the revenged cease. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, moon, the stars which you've ordained, what is man that you take thought of him? And the Son of Man, you care for him. So what the psalmist has done is reflected on what we talked about at the beginning. Now, he didn't know what we know, probably. I don't know what all God would have shown him, but I mean, this vastness, that when we use the numbers to describe the vastness and the glory of the universe, we can't follow the conversation. Because the numbers are so vast that we don't have anything to compare it to. And so we just kind of get lost in it. It's just this grand glory of unbelievable, unimaginable, unthinkable grandeur and space. And what is it even all for? I mean, that it takes millions and billions of years to traverse, going at 186,000 miles a second. You understand if you drive your car, you can't get there. Do you know that? You cannot get there. So it's far beyond us, isn't it? I mean, we could put the gas to the floor and drive our entire life and never get anywhere. So it's far beyond for us. It's just when God does it, He does it in a grand way. And so the psalmist is saying, you know, when I reflect on that, I don't get just hung up on that. Where I get hung up is, why do you even consider a human being? Why do you care about what I would do in the morning? Why do you care about the hurt that I've gone through? And that's what this astrophysicist who became a Christian, having studied all of this vastness and knows it far better than I would even begin to even understand to talk to her. I couldn't even talk to her. And she said, but what really is something is that he cares for what's going to happen to you tomorrow. That's really the greatest mystery of all of that. Let's pray. Lord, we love you and we thank you for loving us. And we just began to contemplate when we think about angels how vast everything really is. Far beyond us. It doesn't all revolve around us, but you have, because of your own plan, you have created man in your image, which you did not do for the angels. And you've sent a Redeemer so that we could live for eternity. And Lord, we thank you for that. May our mind, when we think about the greatness of the universe, the galaxies, the billions of stars and all of these things, may it always bring us back to where the psalmist came. What of man? Who am I that you would be so concerned and humble us before you. We love you in Christ's name. Amen.